You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Does your parent, grandparent, or political representative suffer from climate change denial disorder? CCDD is a rapidly spreading disease that World Health officials say, if left untreated, could destroy the entire planet.
There's nothing more relaxing than being out here in the water.
Hey, get out of the way!
Climate change denial disorder is a rapidly spreading disease that attacks the neurons, making it impossible to comprehend basic words like world, melting, not good, science, and factual.
They say the temperatures are higher than normal these days. I think that's a bunch of new age hooey garbage. It's snowing right now. Who cares if I'm in Southern California?
I don't believe the ice caps are melting. I believe the polar bears are just getting fatter and weighing them down. Ever think of that, hippies?
I'm gonna wait till more horrible shit happens to our planet. And I'm a senator, so fortunately, I get to make those decisions for all of us. You're welcome.
I'm not a scientist. Who listens to those nerds anyway?
Droughts. We're fine!
56% of Republicans in Congress have been severely infected with CCDD and need your help immediately. They include Jim Inhofe, Lisa Murkowski, Steve Daines, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Joni Ernst, Rodney Davis, Mike Pompeo, Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, Andy Harris, Ann Wagner, Jeff Sessions, Scott Garrett, Jimmy Fox, John Boehner, Bill Schuster, Paul Ryan, and many, many more. Doctors say the only known cure for CCDD is a Q-tip, so you or your Republican representative can clean the shit out of your ears so you'll be able to listen to scientists who know more about science than you do. Results may vary.
Something is killing millions of people around the world, including in your city, but we don't want to know what it is. And the same something is the second largest global warming substance after carbon dioxide, and few people know that either. We'll investigate with Jonathan Mingle and his new book, Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. Jonathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's very good to be with you.
We have a long way to travel to the Himalayas, so recently brought into the spotlight by the massive earthquake in Nepal. But let's start closer to home. Why did U.S. President Obama make his most recent climate announcement in a hospital?
Well, you know, I think he was trying to highlight the fact that the pollution, much of the same pollution that drives climate change, is also implicated in some serious health problems. And it's not something that's been on our radar screen until relatively recently in terms of public awareness. But a lot of, whether you're looking at smokestacks from industrial sources or tailpipes from vehicles, along with the carbon dioxide coming out of them, in many cases, you have other forms of pollution, particularly particulate pollution. And the one that I've been focused on in researching and in writing the book is black carbon. And black carbon is really just what scientists call these ultrafine particles that are products of incomplete combustion. And the reason we're worried about those is it's those really small particles that can penetrate deep in the lungs and cause a lot of damage to human health. So I think President Obama has wisely started talking more about the immediate health impacts of being exposed to all kinds of pollution, and the fact that, you know, climate change is not just this abstract problem that's happening to people far away or far in the future. The pollution that's driving it is also putting us at risk here and now.
Yes, there was a study that happened in Brooklyn, and it's been followed up, that showed that pollution from cars and factories, all sources, can actually change the DNA of babies in the womb. And that was pretty scary. And yet, people don't seem to demand more action on this. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, if you look back at the history of clean air advocacy and legislation, you know, usually it's taken some kind of terrible precipitating event like the killer fog in London in the early 1950s that led to Britain's clean air legislation. Or if you go to China right now and you look at, you know, the air quality problems they're dealing with, finally people are starting to say, you know, look, it's hard for me to breathe, it's dangerous for my child to be, you know, out and about in Beijing, got to do something about this. So it takes these kinds of events, and it happened in New York City in the 60s as well, or look at L.A. in the 70s, or Pittsburgh in the 1940s. You know, it reaches a point where it's so bad and so in your face and in your lungs that people get fed up. And I think we're in a moment right now where people are sitting up and paying attention to that in a way that they weren't just a few years ago. If you go to, for instance, New Delhi, where I interviewed a lot of folks for the book, the air quality in a lot of cities in India is really the worst in the world, worse even than in China. But finally, people are saying this is a problem that demands immediate action.
Yeah, it's strange. You discovered one root of this black carbon problem in a faraway mountain valley. Tell us about the location that stars in your new book, Fire and Ice.
So at the narrative heart of the book is the story of this village I've spent a lot of time in the last several years. It's called Kumik, and Kumik is a village of about 45 households in a valley called Zanskar. And this is in a remote part of the northwest Himalaya in North India. And Kumik is on the receiving end of both the climate impacts of black carbon and the health impacts of being exposed to soot pollution. They rely almost entirely on burning dung for heating their homes. And this is a place that gets very cold in the winter. It's 12,000 feet high. It's not a lot of trees grow up there because it's in the rain shadow formed by the Himalaya. So they depend almost entirely on melting snow and ice for irrigating their crops. And they depend largely on solid fuels, so dung and a little bit of wood that they gather for cooking and heating. And so my first encounter in Kumik was in 2008. I was working in Zanskar on passive solar heating designs with some communities, and I discovered that this was a whole village that was in the process of moving because they've been in a terrible drought for the last few decades, and it's just getting worse and worse. You know, it took a while to connect the dots of their slow-motion catastrophe to this larger global issue of black carbon, but it was pretty astonishing when I started looking into it, just the scope of the damage caused by black carbon and juxtaposed with the fact of how little we seem to talk about it.
You know, it's interesting. I talked to an atmospheric scientist who is from India, and he said, well, you know, even my auntie is cooking indoors with very little ventilation and creating this black carbon soot, but she thinks that the food tastes better that way. It's the traditional way to cook. It's going to be difficult to get the people of India to change away from that.
That's exactly right. And people have been trying to do this for decades with relatively little success. You know, there was a government program in the 1980s and 90s in India that tried to bring what they called improved cook stoves to people across the country, especially in rural villages. And it largely failed because, you know, they took an engineering approach to a wicked complex problem that has a lot of cultural factors. And you know, you need to understand how does that woman in the rural village in Uttar Pradesh spend her day, and what kind of fuel is she gathering, and what kind of foods is she cooking, and, you know, what are her preferences for the design of a stove? And that may vary from Uttar Pradesh just next door to in Bihar, the neighboring state. And you really need tailored solutions if you're going to help people embrace cleaner options for cooking. So that's to say either biomass cook stoves that burn wood or animal dung much more cleanly, or alternatives like gas or electric cooking, biogas, and they have to be affordable. So it is a challenging problem, but finally, I think there's some cause for hope on that front because more companies are trying to figure out how to solve it, and there are these enabling mechanisms like the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves, which is really taking a holistic approach.
Well, before we cycle back to India and the Himalayas to see how one village responds, I'd first like to understand a bit more about how black carbon affects climate change. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, black carbon, you know, it's really the scientist's term of art for the stuff in soot that makes soot dark. And so if you're a climate scientist, the reason you care about black carbon is in its name. It's dark. And just think of any dark rock sitting out in the sun. After a while, you come back and touch it, it's going to be warm to the touch. And, you know, that is the main mechanism by which black carbon adds energy to the atmosphere. It absorbs light across the different wavelengths, and it turns it into heat. It re-radiates it as heat. And then a second mechanism is if that black carbon, and again, think of a microscopic little dark rock that gets deposited on snow and ice, so a glacier in the Northwest Himalaya, for example, it is going to reduce the amount of light that that snow reflects back to space. And so then that triggers these feedback loops, and it adds energy to that snow and ice, and it accelerates melting. And then there's a third way that black carbon influences climate, and that's through interactions with clouds. And that's where it's a lot more complex, and, you know, scientists are trying to figure out, well, does it reduce the amount of cloud formation, or does it increase it, and clouds reflect light to space? So if you sum up those three mechanisms, and there was an exhaustive study a couple years ago led by Tammy Bond, a scientist at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and a recent MacArthur Fellow for her work on black carbon. And they found that when you add it all up, it is definitely net warming. And in fact, it's the second biggest contributor to climate change, as you mentioned in your intro, after carbon dioxide.
Yes, we had Tammy Bond on Radio EcoShock. We were pleased to hear from her. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Jonathan Mingle, author of Fire and Ice. Well, you've alluded to something that confuses me and I think confuses some listeners. It seems like air pollution can play both sides of the game. On one hand, it can add another heat-trapping blanket near the surface, but other types of air pollution deflect sunlight back into space, helping cool things. How can we sort out the different ways that this is acting?
Yeah, and it's really important to keep in mind that black carbon is rarely emitted by itself. So usually you think of, you know, think of a campfire that you might be sitting around, and when it's really hot and the flame is leaping, you know, maybe you've got some darker smoke coming out of it. That means there's more black carbon. Flaming combustion produces black carbon. But, you know, maybe then the fire cools down a bit or starts to rain and you get more lighter colored smoke. So out of a wood fire, for instance, you've also got things like organic carbon and sulfates coming out of that smoke. And those are lighter colored particles, and they reflect light when they're up in the atmosphere. So it's not always the case that if you cleaned up that fire, you're going to get a huge benefit in terms of reduced warming. It's true if a lot of those particulates are in fact black carbon. So an example would be diesel exhaust or smoke coming out of kerosene lamps, which are used widely in the developing world for lighting because people don't have access to good alternatives. That smoke is almost, kerosene smoke, almost 99% black carbon. But if you look at a wildfire, or if you go to Punjab, where a farmer is burning his rice straw after the harvest to get rid of it, then maybe that smoke has a lot of other stuff in it that might not be directly warming. But at the end of the day, when you talk to the folks who really study this very closely, there's a consensus emerging that even from those fires, biofuel fires, the net signal is warming. It's when you sum up all the stuff coming out of those fires, it's contributing warming.
Now, some people talk about what could happen if we stop burning fossil fuels today. That's usually the phrase used. But if hundreds of millions of people depend on old-style carbon sources for cooking food, even if industrial civilization collapsed or had a big economic crash, this form of pollution would keep on coming.
Well, you know, when you think about the fact, and I'm kind of astonished anew every time I think about it or recite it, that almost 3 billion people around the world still use solid fuels to cook their meals or heat their homes, so dung, wood, coal, and they're burning it in very crude ways. Why are they doing that? You know, if you go into a kitchen in Kumik, you know, I've asked lots of people there if they think the smoke's bad for them. They say, well, yeah, of course it is, but what are we to do? You know, what's our alternative? So the reason people do it is because they don't have access to cleaner alternatives. It costs nothing to go out the door and go gather some dung, some dried dung that you can burn in your stove. So if you're going to try to help that person clean up their kitchen by burning in a cleaner way, it's got to compete with that that zero cost option. You know, there's a time cost and an energy cost and labor, but you go to the woman in rural Uttar Pradesh and she's a very sophisticated customer if you're trying to sell her a better stove. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And I think finally we have some stoves that they're not perfect, but they offer promise for that cook who can't spend a lot of her modest income on other fuels, but through smart design and user-centered design, you know, there are stoves now that can burn dung or can burn wood and approach the cleanliness of burning with gas, you know, that blue flame that we're familiar with here in the U.S. if you cook with gas. We've known for a long time how to improve combustion. If you add air, you burn the fire hotter, you mix air with the fuel more effectively, you're going to produce less black carbon. So that's what we need more of. We need more experiments and more kind of smart design for this user who's been neglected for a long time, her needs.
Now, you mentioned that the villagers where you stayed in the Himalayas are likely going to have to move. And this reminds me a little bit about people moving away from California because of the drought there. Do we know why it's getting drier in their valley?
We don't know for sure. And this is one of the challenges when I was writing the book, is there isn't a lot of good data in a lot of parts of the Himalayas. It's a remote region. It's tough to do research there. It's dangerous. It's expensive to do field studies of glaciers and how they change over time. There are some studies in Zanskar that suggest most of the glaciers surveyed are in retreat. And we can safely guess, based on the research that has been done, that certainly globally average climate change, carbon dioxide, and other greenhouse gas driven warming is partly to blame. But the Himalaya and the high Arctic are warming 2 to 3 times as fast as the global average. And so scientists used to sit around and scratch their heads and say, why is this happening? And we now know with a good degree of confidence, not with certainty, but we never have that in science, that black carbon is responsible for at least half of the observed glacier and snowfield retreat in the Himalayas. And it's probably responsible for half or more of observed warming in the Arctic. It's kind of like, well, how much information do you need to know when to act? And no one has ever climbed the mountain above Kumik and measured black carbon concentrations up there. It'd be great if someone could do that study, but in the absence of that study, or even an epidemiological study saying that the reason infant mortality rates in this village and other villages in Zanskar and Ladakh remain so high, it has something to do with the smoke that they're breathing through the winter and respiratory illness. We don't have 100% certainty, but I think it's safe to say we know enough now to recommend some ambitious, coordinated actions to tackle this pollution.
So, Jonathan Mingle, your book title talks about solidarity. Why?
So, you know, in a way, there were two stories that seemed to me to merit a wider hearing that I encountered, and they're connected. And one is the black carbon story and how it's affecting communities like Kumik, but also communities even in California or New York City and New Delhi. And the other story was the story of this village, and I worked alongside them and gathered their stories over the years, and I was just amazed by how they faced this catastrophe, leaving their 1,000-year-old village, which has been lovingly kind of cultivated down through the generations, and going into the unknown to build a new village from scratch in a pretty hostile, windy, hot, treeless, dusty plain, little to no outside help. And I thought, well, wow, why are they, when they go down there, why are they laughing and singing songs and it feels like a party when we're working there? And I think part of the answer, spoiler alert, if you're going to read the book, is that they have these traditions that are the product of long experience in how to live in a really tough part of the world. They depend on snowmelt, they depend on dung for their hearth fires, but they depend on each other is the real answer. And they have sophisticated labor and resource sharing traditions and cultural practices that I think the rest of us could learn a lot from, even as they're slowly disappearing as these communities get more connected to kind of the globalized markets of the world. And that's the solidarity piece. So in a way, I was treating Kumik's story as a microcosm that we can learn from when trying to tackle at this more global scale what seem to be seemingly intractable problems. So climate change, but also, you know, how do you lift the billions who remain in poverty out of poverty without you know, cooking the climate even more. And I think black carbon sits at the overlapping part of that Venn diagram, climate action, action to alleviate poverty. And I was just inspired by how people in Kumik are kind of rebuilding their lives and some of them embracing solar heating and alternatives to this dirty combustion. And it was just really striking to me how that example of how if you just buckle down and work together, you can get some amazing things done.
It's strange, Jonathan, that most of us have been focused on ice loss in the Arctic and more recently the Antarctic. But now you raise this third pole, as it were, the ice on the world's highest mountains. I know millions of people depend on that water. Is this a problem that's starting now, a water shortage due to melting glaciers, or is it something that is 200 years from now? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it depends where you are. So you could think of Kumik as kind of on the leading edge of that, the impact of those changes. So in their case, what's happening is less and less snow falls each winter. And, you know, there's natural variability in that, but the trend seems pretty clear. And then spring arrives earlier and earlier. And that means that they run out of water often by August before the harvest. So they can look out their window, see how much snow fell that winter and try to gauge how much they should plant so they don't lose their crops. In other parts of the Himalaya, what people are seeing is, you know, if you go to the eastern Himalaya, it's more of a monsoon-driven snow regime. So those glaciers are replenished in the summertime, whereas the far northwest, like Zanskar, it's in the wintertime. So there are different ways this is playing out across the region. But this trend of warmer winters, earlier springs is pretty common, what you hear from talking to people across the region. And the impacts will probably peak much later. So what some scientists forecast is, well, at first you'll have increased runoff, right, as temperatures rise and more of that kind of frozen reservoir gets released. But as it runs off, if you're not able to capture it and use it, it's kind of wasting that storage function. And then, you know, if you go further later into this century, and again, this is kind of our best guesses. Nobody knows when the Himalayan glaciers are going to disappear, but, you know, the best current guess is that the peak melting will happen in the latter part of this century. And then after that, you can think of this long tail of increasing dryness. So these rivers that depend seasonally on glacier and snow melt to feed them, so the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow, they could conceivably, you know, a century from now, be dry for part of the year, or significantly drier.
You just listed what I would call where the majority of the world's people live when you talk about those rivers. You know, it sounds to me as we wrap up here, Jonathan, that you kind of fell in love with this place, that you're maintaining a long-distance marriage or something.
Yeah, that's a very fair description. And the book is in part a love letter to this culture and these people whose lives are changing rapidly. And not just, you know, the environmental changes are pretty striking, but also economic changes are kind of wrapped up with that too. And it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch them leave this beautiful village. And, you know, they probably got sick of me asking them over and over, well, aren't you sad to be leaving this place? And oftentimes they look at me like, you know, what are you, thick? If you don't have water, you have nothing. People would tell me that over and over. And you see it in California today, in parts of California, people realizing the same thing. If you don't have water, well, that's top of your list of worries. So to the extent to which we can maybe learn a little bit from their story, you know, I think they'd be pleased to hear that they function as a model for not just resilience, but also how to get together and have a good time while you're solving problems. That's their credo.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking about the links between cooking fire soot, industrial pollution, climate change, and your health. And it's all wrapped together in the new book, Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. We've been talking with the author, Jonathan Mingle. Find more links to this issue and the book in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Jonathan, thanks for traveling with us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.